Hi, I'm Ryan Lizza, the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker.
And I'm Noam Scheiber, a staff writer at The New Republic, Ryan Lizza's former institutional home.
That's right. Good to be on with you, Noam.
Likewise. Yeah, really excited about this.
I haven't done this in a long time, so I'm very excited.
Good. Well, why don't we get right to it? You wrote a really terrific piece about Sheila Bair in it's still the latest issue, right?
Yeah, it's this week's issue.
Still the latest issue, and it's Chairman Bair, not Chairwoman or something else.
Well,
yeah. I noticed that that's how she
I actually made the mistake at one point of calling her Sheila, and I was corrected and told it's Chairman Bair. Or Chair Bear, if you prefer.
Chair Bear, yes. Yeah. I actually do prefer that, I think. I'll do that from now on.
So what did you think of the piece? In all honesty, you cover this stuff more closely than I do, quite honestly. So I'm interested in your unvarnished take.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting. A couple of questions for you about it. But the first question is just, you know, she's not trained. She doesn't have an academic background in as a finance economist or something. And she's
right.
certainly not someone who comes from a Wall Street background. And it's sort of
right.
interesting that, you know, if you ask a lot of people, certainly on the left, center left, they think her instincts are kind of exactly right.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, so I guess I'm almost wondering
yeah.
if there's something to, like, not being an expert and not being from Wall Street. You know, is it
yeah.
like, help your perspective?
That came up in a lot of the folks I talked to about her, the people that really like her. You know, they would talk, you know, she's the only person on the economic team, and this isn't really true, but she's often described by folks on the left as the only person on the economic team, and actually, it's not even quite true that she's on the economic
right,
team,
right.
in fact, but the only person who deals with these issues in the administration and has some seat at the table, who's not, you know, a lot of liberals will say linked to the
right.
money center banks, and there's this whole. I tried to do this lightly because I wasn't quite sure how true it was in the end. But there's something to it. There's something to this Kansas Midwestern
yes.
thing against the New York Wall Street centric folks. There's definitely something there, and she very self consciously describes herself as a Kansas Republican,
right.
not just a Republican. When she told me she was a Republican, she was almost apologetic.
Right.
And she said, you know, I'm a Republican in the tradition of
Alf Landon or whatever.
Of White from Kansas.
Oh, right, yes, of course, right.
And, you know, that whole tradition, you know, the white Republicans became Teddy Roosevelt Republicans.
Right.
They left the Republican Party
right.
And became progressives. And that's really the tradition that she comes out of and sees herself as a part of. You know, there's this Honig, the chairman of the Fed
right.
in, I believe, Kansas City. You know, he's another one that ideologically
yeah.
seems to be in line with her. So there's one more data point that there's
right.
a regional difference here.
Right.
And I didn't point this out in the piece, but you know, one of the reasons we have a Fed that is regional and is broken up by region is exactly to make sure that the New York banks don't dominate
right.
The economic policy making. And so I think there is something to your point about the regional difference, the sort of Midwest and versus the Wall Street New York crowd.
Right. And the other thing I thought was really interesting about the piece is her radicalizing experience, to the extent that she had one, as you said,
yeah.
I mean, maybe this was always kind of a piece with her worldview dating back from, you know, her adolescence or young adulthood. But it is interesting that this, you know, early sort of radicalizing event was the first time that she was, or the only time, I guess, she was on the CFTC commission and or the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. And this was back in the early 90s when Wendy Graham, you know, did what a lot of people consider like the original sin, which was exempting,
yeah.
You know, exempting derivatives kind of the first time around. And,
yeah.
You know, I sort of think of her, I think a lot of people who cover this think of her as someone who just kind of tangled with the second Bush administration and tangled with Paulson. And
yeah.
But it's interesting that it dates back, you know, to fairly early on in her career.
Yeah, and if you sort of line up all the villains in the current economic crisis,
right.
and in the economic crises of the last decade, I mean, Wendy Graham really does have a special
yeah,
place.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
Wendy and Phil, really, but
and Phil. I mean, Wendy Graham.
Yeah, was, even more.
She, you know, she worked as a regulator, did Enron's bidding.
Right.
You know, now Enron in some ways looks like small potatoes, but she did the Enron's bidding, and then literally months later went to work for Enron. And the New York Times at one point published these emails. This is a bit of a digression, but it's worth bashing Wendy Graham.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the Times did publish some emails that I believe came out in one of the trials related to Enron, where Wendy Graham or some of the Enron folks are trying to get some advice from Wendy Graham, who I believe was on the board at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And she starts talking about the people that she worked with on the CFTC.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't mention Sheila Bair by name, but it's clear that she's talking about Sheila Bair. And she talks to she's telling the Enron people how everyone she worked with on the CFTC was totally, as she said, anti-free market.
Uh-huh. That's
the way she put it.
Right.
And you couldn't trust any of them, and that they were all, you know, they were all determined to destroy the free market system. Wendy's judgment turned out to be bad on many levels.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're right. I think that was the first time where Bear came up against sort of free market purists who didn't understand the role of regulation.
Right.
And her big point, you know, what she did, it gets very technical, but what she did in this opinion that I wrote about, she was simply saying, she was simply saying we shouldn't unilaterally give up our anti-fraud oversight
right.
of this product.
Right.
Let's not regulate it. Fine, let's
right.
monitor it for a few years with a light touch, but don't give up the CFTC's anti-fraud protection.
Right.
That's insane.
Right.
And that was her main point there. And you know, I think she thought she was being rather reasonable.
Right.
But it was a moment where it was a sort of peak moment for the anti-regulation worldview, I think, in Washington.
Right.
And she, like you said, it did. I think it did radicalize her a bit.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I mean, this kind of relates back to the first point, but I do think that, and you see this with Bear, that you know, I don't want to make the case for like total crudeness and lack of sophistication with financial products when you're regulating this stuff. But
yeah.
There is something to be said for a certain lack of sophistication, because then you're sort of relying more on intuition, and intuition, you know,
yeah.
turns out to get you like a long way. I think, you know, I've seen this in a couple other contexts. You see it sometimes on the Hill. I remember going to the Tim Geithner's confirmation hearing, and the senator who was giving him the most problems and really kind of roughing him up was Maria Cantwell. And you know, she, you know, in all honesty, she was kind of terrible, like with the lingo and the jargon, and she would like screw up, like, you know, I don't want to say something her staff's gonna forget about it, but she just, you know, credit to false spot, she just wasn't very fluent, you know.
Yeah.
And you could see Geithner almost wincing and like correcting her from time to time, or at least like contemplating whether he should correct her. But when you kind of peeled back her lack of fluency, she was asking some really good questions, and they were important questions, and questions that you'd want a senator to ask when you're about to make someone the country's top economic official. And I just think that who knows, she may have like some super smart lawyer on her staff who's prepping her, but it did seem like, you know, a certain amount of intuition got her a decent amount of the way and made up for a lack of sophistication. And you see a little of that in Bear. You know, on the House, there's this guy, Alan Grayson, I think, who's like this former prosecutor. And he's the same. You know, I saw a video of
the House Banking Committee or something?
I think so, yeah. And Financial Services, yeah. And I think, you know, I saw a testimony of him, you know, him questioning Geithner and testimony. It was a similar thing. You know, he kind of stumbled over terms and occasionally get, like, causality wrong, and like, you know, what a bank did versus, you know, a non-bank financial institution, and Geithner would kind of wince, and you know, and again, I'm not saying I want to just across the board like these guys making economic policy, but it does seem like it's a nice compliment on an economic team or a group of officials overseeing, you know, financial institutions, just to have someone who kind of relies on intuition.
And I think it would be unfair to compare Bear
right.
to Cantwell or to someone, and I don't know how sophisticated Cantwell is about these issues, but to compare her to someone who really doesn't know the basics.
Right. No,
you know what I mean? That's unfair.
Yeah.
But I think you're right that there's something about her background, and there's something about the way that she approaches these issues that is frankly very different than the core of Obama's economic team. And you know, maybe it's just spin on her part, but I think it's borne out in the policies she's put forward. She really does have a sort of which is unique for someone at the head of the FDIC, a very pro-consumer bent, always trying to think, like, at the end of the day, what does this mean for the, you know, that guy that has the mortgage? You know, that's what her mortgage modification plan was all about.
Right.
And this leads to a lot of criticism, both internally in this administration and in the Bush administration, that she's naive,
right,
that she doesn't really understand these issues.
Right, right.
You know, the Paulson and the Bush folks just thought her obsession with modifying mortgages was completely misplaced and naive.
Right.
And, you know, frankly, the jury's still out on whether mortgage modifications is, you know, the Obama plan hasn't really gotten off the ground yet in some sense. And so we don't know the answer to how much that's gonna do. But yeah, so I think there's a certain common sense that she brings to the table. You know, it strikes me sometimes dumb questions.
Right.
This is almost separate. I'm not saying she asks dumb questions, but frankly, sometimes dumb questions are the best questions. You learn that as a journalist, especially when you go into situations, you know, frankly, all the time, where you don't know a whole lot and you're trying to learn a lot in a very short amount of time. And you do realize that asking the basics, starting with first principles, can often get very revealing answers.
I think that's right. Look, I mean, if a lot of, like, you know, credit rating analysts had asked a lot of dumb questions, you want us to rate this AAA except it's just got a bunch of junk in it, that would have, like, gotten us a long way. So I agree. I'm all in favor of asking sort of dumb, you know, intuitive questions. A final point on this, which you touched on before we move on. You know, so you hit on why the Bush administration people kind of didn't like her. We're now in a different administration, and these same, you know, the people now in those positions that Obama appointed don't seem to like her either. You hear different things in the press. You know, it's she's not a team player. You know, everyone talks about that Citigroup deal where Washington Mutual that she nixed the merger with Citigroup and
Wells Fargo came in with the argument for nixing the Citigroup deal, to me, seems unimpeachable.
Right.
Wells Fargo came in, was offering, like...
a better deal, right?
Yeah, many times more. Yeah. I think it was, like, $2 billion versus 13, or don't hold me to these numbers, but it was, like, $2 billion versus $13 billion. And there was no FDIC exposure.
Right.
She was a central player if Citigroup had done it. The FDIC would have been insuring...
Right. The Washington Mutual assets.
Yeah. Exactly. The Wells Fargo deal had no FDIC exposure.
Right.
And,
right.
you know, she's been heavily criticized for this because she basically encouraged Wells Fargo.
Right. Is it Washington Mutual or Wachovia? Am I confusing the two? Anyway, sorry. One went to J.P. Morgan and one went to Wells Fargo, but sorry.
It's in the piece if readers want to check. I'm confusing the two. But the purchasing bank was Citigroup versus Wells Fargo.
Exactly.
The Citigroup deal got scuttled. With Bear's encouragement, Wells Fargo came in, and she came under a lot of fire for doing that. I think in hindsight, she's been, you know, then what happened to Citigroup is their share price plunged by like 60%.
Right. Which they blame on her, right?
Yeah, they blame that on her. I mean, it was an obvious effect of that deal collapsing.
Right.
And she's been giving Citigroup a hard time ever since. But just to go back to your question, here's the basic criticism from, for lack of a better term, the sort of Treasury Department view of Sheila Bair. And that is, people there will tell you she cares more about protecting the FDIC as an institution than she does about solving this financial crisis.
Right.
That's what I heard over and over again from her critics.
And do you buy it?
I think she's definitely an institutionalist, and she definitely cares about the FDIC and thinks of it... And she really takes seriously the idea that it's an independent agency. You know, has she done that at the expense of solving the larger financial crisis? I don't see the evidence for that. And you know, on a few of these debates, I think she's been right. With PPIP, for instance, you probably have written about this as well. This is the program that's supposed to get the bad loans and bad securities off the bank's books. It's forever been stalled. Bear is supposed to run the part that gets the loans off the books. Treasury is supposed to run the part that gets the securities off the books.
Right.
So the banks that hold these assets basically wanted to game the system, right, where the banks themselves would be able to purchase their own assets.
Right.
But
with government
finance. I mean, it was just like one of those moments where you just realize these guys don't get it,
right,
and don't care.
Right.
And she was maybe there are other voices, but she was one of the main voices making sure that could not happen.
Right.
So, the other criticism of her has been that the FDIC's insurance fund has run very, very low, and that she didn't do enough early on to either to protect the fund. And one way you do that is the banks taxpayers don't pay for that fund, the banks themselves pay for it. So some people say early on she should have raised some more money from the banks for the fund once she saw the crisis coming.
Right. So you don't think it's just snobbery that they're like, well, this woman, has never worked at a major financial institution or doesn't have.
It's tough to say. I'd be hesitant to to ascribe those psychological motives to her critics, but this has come up in the reporting.
Yeah.
I try not to make too much of it, but. Yeah, I think there's something there.
I'm agnostic about it too, for the record.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think there are, some of her defenders argued to me that it's a gender issue.
Yeah.
It's the boys, it's all the big boys with Wall Street ties, and they don't like, the girl from Kansas.
Right.
So it's always hard to judge that kind of personal psychological stuff at the root of it. But I think you don't even have to go there because there are enough clear ideological disagreements between the two camps.
It's overdetermined here. So let's move on. I mean, obviously a sort of related issue is the big regulatory reform package that Obama and Geithner unveiled a week or two ago. What's your, having reported this story, you probably developed a view kind of more broadly about what kind of needs to be done. What's your sense? I mean, is this ambitious enough? Does it get to the right? Does it, it could be, ambitious in the right ways, but not focusing on the right problems. I mean, what's your take?
Well, one of the things that I learned in reporting this is that the conflict between Treasury and FDIC did change the parameters of the plan at the end. So, one of the main parts of the plan is you have to have some system in place to unwind these really large institutions when they fail. So you don't have another Lehman Brothers.
Sure.
And Geithner's been saying for a while now he just doesn't have the tools to do this.
Right.
Although there there's some out there
that
say he does.
If you really wanted to, you could.
Yeah, you could do. I guess like a negotiated conservatorship, right?
Right.
The federal government has all the power in that institution. You could go to a Lehman or to a Citigroup and say, we're taking you over, here's how we're going to unwind you, and they would have to do it. I've talked to Treasury people, made that argument, and they said, one of the most senior people there said to me that is just not possible, because what happens during the period of negotiation is that the investors just flee
and
place collapse.
You
melt down, and then the government's on the hook for everything.
Yeah.
So, fair enough argument.
These are
complicated issues, and I think everyone should be sort of modest
about
how sure they are that one solution works over another. But one thing that I think did happen is the fight that Geithner and Baer were having over Citigroup. For readers, that people haven't read the piece, basically Baer basically thinks, I think if she were honest, that Citigroup should be broken up and its management should be changed.
Right.
And as the head of the FDIC, that's what she does when she takes over a
small
bank.
Banks, yeah.
Yeah, if it's a small bank and the management sucks, you go in there and you clear them out and you bring good people in. So she sort of raised this with Citigroup. It leaked into the press. Geithner, on the other hand, thinks that Citigroup has a turnaround plan in place, that the leadership isn't, is in general okay, and that Citigroup needs a little bit more time to try and right the ship. Originally, in late March, when he announced the outlines of his plan, the deal was that FDIC, this gets very technical, but very important, FDIC and Treasury together would decide how you unwind a firm that's taken into receivership. And the two choices are either do what they're doing now, give them, pump them with cash, or you do what the FDIC does with failed banks.
Right.
You take them apart and sell them.
Pieces,
When the plan came out, it was no longer a joint decision-making process. All the decision-making authority was at the Treasury. Now, they could appoint, and they will appoint, if they get this authority, the FDIC to do the work of breaking up a company or taking it into receivership. But the authority to make that judgment in the first place is all at Treasury. The FDIC was shocked when they saw the fine print and saw that this authority had been taken from them. Mm-hmm. And I think the best explanation for why is this battle that was happening simultaneously over Citigroup. Mm-hmm. Because if Chilabert has the authority, if this year Congress gives Chilabert the authority, Citigroup is toast.
She's going to use it, yeah.
Exactly.
You know, one thing
And then the next thing we should probably talk about is this too big to fail phenomenon. Because
sure.
I'm curious to hear what you think about that, because I think that's sort of central to this debate.
Absolutely. Let's talk about that. One question before we get to that, though, is, you know, I think it's interesting, and maybe you can this is sort of an empirically resolvable question that you know the answer to, because even in the reporting, in the run-up, you know, 2-3 days before the plan was unveiled, the 85 or 88-page white paper, whatever it was, you sort of got intimations in the financial press that, like, okay, obviously Treasury is going to have a big role, but, you know, clearly the idea is you're going to need to wind down these institutions in a Lehman Brothers-type situation, and if you get to that point, it's going to be the FDIC that's doing the actual executing of the winding down.
That's true.
Which, even if, you know, the decision-making authority isn't exclusively theirs, it's still a large amount of authority, because you can fire management, you can sell off pieces.
That's true.
So do you think that sort of changed, or is that true, but the FDIC thought they just would even have more authority even than that?
They thought the big change, and it's very it's basically like two words.
Yeah.
You know, you go to the Treasury Department's website and look at the fact sheet that they put out the day, I think it was March 26th, the day that Geithner announced the plan, and it says that FDIC and Treasury will decide how to resolve a failed institution.
Right.
You go to the flash forward to the white paper. It says this is not exact, but it's close. All power to decide how institutions will be resolved is vested in Treasury.
Yeah,
that's a very important distinction.
The how is what is the key. I totally agree with you.
The FDIC has two pretty big roles. One. Yeah. They are supposed to advise the Treasury on when if they see an institution that is too big to fail, that is maybe what they think is insolvent and needs to be taken to receivership. The FDIC board is supposed to vote on that and then recommend to the Treasury Department that an institution be taken into receivership. But again, the Treasury makes the final decision.
Right.
So the Treasury decides the trigger. And then they decide, okay, how do we resolve it?
That's key. I agree with you. That's the key. And so when in the process do you think that changed? Because I think even going into the last couple of days, there was an assumption that the FDIC would get the how, even if Treasury got the yes or no.
Got the original trigger, yes. I honestly was not – that was my understanding, but basically based on reading what was being reported in the press and just assuming from the late March stuff that wasn't going to change.
I
tried to point this out. I tried to make a big deal out of it in the piece because I think it was something that was missed in the reporting.
I agree with you.
In the original reporting. Most of the original reporting focused on, you know, what is obviously a crucial issue is how the administration views the issue of too big to fail in general, whether you prevent it or whether you just try and mitigate the damage. So... I know the FDIC was surprised that they were that authority had changed, and I'm quite sure that that Sheila Bair is going to be talking to Barney Frank and Chris Todd,
her congressional patrons, right?
Absolutely, she does have a sort of independent base up there. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the too big to fail question. I mean, you know, I did a blogging heads a week or two ago with Megan McArdle at The Atlantic, and this came up, and, you know, I was sort of exercised about too big to fail, and the administration wasn't doing enough, and she pushed back and said, I'm sympathetic, but we're really talking about too complex to fail. You know, you could have a big, plain vanilla commercial bank that just did regular business loans that didn't have all these links to other parts of the financial system, and if it failed, it would be a big deal, but it wouldn't necessarily drag down the whole system. And so I think she sort of persuaded me that, like, yeah, we should be focused on too complex to fail, not too big to fail. And so I guess, you know, my feeling is...
It comes back to systemic risk, exactly.
Yeah. And I think... You know, I think, look, derivatives are kind of where a lot of the action is. The administration, to its credit, like, wants to require a centralized clearing, which, you know, is basically, instead of me trading with you, trading with a third party, trading with a fourth party, we all trade, like, a centralized place. So if one of us defaults, it doesn't bring down the whole chain. It just bring, you know, we default on our own. I think that's a good idea. But the big loophole, I guess, is sort of customized derivatives versus standardized. And so the idea is... if it's just a regular cookie-cutter derivative that everyone trades, it'll go on this clearinghouse. But if you and I want to, you know, kind of reach some exotic deal for some oil future or something, you know, that no one else is doing, it's not really going to work on a clearinghouse. So we'll continue. They'll continue to let us just do it, you know, bilaterally, one-on-one. And, you know, I think all the people on the left and the kind of regulatory hawks are really worried. Tom Harkin in the Senate, for example, is really worried that this will be the loophole everyone drives a truck through. And I guess I agree. I think the administration may be right that you just need to let people do these sort of customized or tailors. I think they call them bespoke, like suits on Wall Street. That's the term of art. So these kind of customized derivatives, it's going to be hard to put on a clearinghouse. But, you know, I think you can still basically, I think this goes back to our earlier comments about lack of sophistication or crudeness. No one has sort of explained to me why you can't just limit the size of a portfolio of customized derivatives, right? So I think I looked at this recently. Citigroup had, like, I'm going to screw up the numbers, but they have, like, $1.5 trillion in assets and somewhere in the neighborhood, a couple hundred billion in derivative portfolio. No one's explained to me why you can't just say, no, you can't have a derivatives portfolio, or at least a customized derivatives portfolio, larger than 50 billion or 100 billion. And that seems to me like it would limit this kind of too complex to fail phenomenon. It's very crude. I know that a lot of people, you know, on Wall Street and the banks don't like it, but I've yet to be convinced or even, you know, shown a sort of plausible reason why this is not a good idea.
All right, so you're pushing the limit of my knowledge on the subject. So I need to ask you a question. So if you had an actual, if you had a limit on the size of the portfolio, that would prevent one institution from bringing down the system.
Exactly.
Simply because it couldn't destroy, you know, above a certain percentage of the economy.
Exactly. Yeah. Basically, like, you know, derivatives are a bet. So you and I, you know, a derivative is a bet on an underlying asset. So there's a stock price. You know, I think it's going to go up. You think it's going to go down. We make a bet. That's a derivative. The problem is, if you have so many of these bets, and I have bets with you, and I have bets with 15 other people, and you have bets with 15 other people, if I go down, everyone on the other side of that bet is going down. So my point is just, well, why not just say you can only make so many bets?
Right. And I don't know the answer to this. And this is, you've made this point, I think, Noam, and this is why some people in the administration say it's not too big to fail, it's too interconnected, right?
Absolutely.
It gets to that point. So what has anyone given you an explanation for that, to why that won't work?
Yeah, no one's really done it other than it's just politically sort of, you know, the world as it exists now is companies have these enormous derivatives portfolios, and it's very hard to go back.
Yeah.
And so we should just deal with the reality on the ground and try to manage as best we can with, you know, making them have more capital in case they do start to, looks like they are starting to flame out. So, but you know, I sort of feel like, and we can kind of get into this, but, you know, I feel like to the extent that I have concerns about the way the White House operates kind of strategically is, well, why not go for the most extreme form desirable, you know, why not go for the ideal and then, you know, give yourself some leverage in the legislative process.
You know, they come out with a bargaining position rather than
what they actually want implemented. You know, and right, you know, if your argument is politics, well, we can't then move the goalposts from the beginning and then get back to where you want to end up.
But I mean, the way what you've just described is sort of the how is one of the ways this this plan in general has been criticized, which is it takes the world of finance basically for what it is right now and tries to enhance the regulation of it, but doesn't try to fundamentally alter the way Wall Street works.
I think that's right.
I've talked to them about this, you know, the too big to fail part of this, you know, because Joe Nocera, I think it was a front page column. The day after the plan came out, which is extremely influential, drove the administration absolutely crazy. And for a lot of people who are grappling with these issues for the first time and want like a sort of take on it, I think Nocera, you know, gave them a quick take like, oh, Obama administration not doing enough here. And I know that definitely frustrated people at the White House, and they've been trying to sort of make the opposite case since. The conversations I've had are that people don't understand. You can't. They've looked at every system. They've looked at every regulatory system in the Western world, and it's not that they didn't try to come up with a scheme where you could prevent an institution from ever representing a systemic risk to the financial system. To be redundant there. They looked at all those problems, but every one of them had their own issues. And at the end of the day, this is, you know, they decided to do what they thought worked. Now nobody's actually not, you know, I'm sort of sympathetic, you know, instinctually to the Sheila Bair view on this, and that, you know, you should rather than just take for granted that these companies can get so big and bring down everything. You know, now they have their own official designation, you know, tier one FHC, exactly. So now it's sort of baked into the cake of the system. But looking at all of the possibilities for not becoming a tier one FHC in the first place, what's the brightest idea that you've seen? What's the way that you've seen out there where, you know what, this might work? You know, then you'd never have a Citigroup. You'd never have a Lehman if you did this.
Right.
Anything beyond just the limit on the portfolio?
So a couple of ideas. And let me just say before I get to that, I am not completely unsympathetic to the administration. I think there are legitimate arguments for, you know, structural change just being such a mess. And you don't know the unforeseen consequences. I mean, I am somewhat sympathetic to that argument. I also do think that it's not useless. You know, I'm more bullish on the proposal than Nocera. I think they did advance the ball. Just bringing these systemically important non-bank financial institutions like hedge funds or, you know, into the regulatory umbrella, I think is really important. I mean, Paul Krugman has written about this. I think it's a huge step, and they should be commended for that.
I will say it was a huge sigh of relief when Krugman said, oh, the people who think you can stop too big to fail don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, no, I'm sure they, So I think that the best idea I think I've seen, and again, this may just be sort of in the realm of politically impossible, probably even much more so than my original idea, and it actually comes from this Michael Lewis piece that he did for Portfolio, I think, in December, which was a very good read, and I think accessible to a lay person, just about, you know, how we got here and how we were completely delusional about the mortgage risks that we were taking and the securitization factories on Wall Street. And, you know, his point basically at the end is all these big companies that were, you know, loading up on CDOs full of subprime junk were public corporations, so they were gambling with shareholders' money. And it's just hard to believe that it would have happened, or at least would have happened to the same extent, if these were partnerships, that you know, all the people placing the bets were betting with their own money rather than shareholders' money. So I guess I sort of feel like, you know, the most compelling proposal I've seen is if you are going to bet money, you know, if you're going to trade for your own account with derivatives, you know, subprime securities, real estate, you know, mortgage-backed securities, you have to bet with your own money. You can't bet with shareholder money. So you can be a big bank, you know, make standard commercial loans and be a public company, but if you're going to be have a big portfolio and basically operate like a hedge fund, you have to be a partnership. I think that wouldn't do everything. You know, long-term capital management was a partnership, and they flamed out back in 1998. But I think
that would reduce risk.
I think it would dramatically reduce risk. It would change the sort of moral hazard. You know, the moral hazard, the kind of principal agent problem where you're gambling with other people's money. You know, obviously it wasn't on the agenda. I think, you know, maybe for good reason. Maybe it's just it would be such a, you know, to tell Citigroup, you either can't be a public company or you have to lose the kind of you know, trading part of your operation and just be a bank, would be a wrenching change, and maybe it would just be a war that they don't want to fight when you've got other things. But to me, that's, you know, if you're gonna, if we're talking about structural changes, that you get the most bang for your buck there. You know, the only other proposal I've seen that sort of comes close, and I think it's probably more subtle and maybe more reasonable, is, and there's a version of this in the reform. I just don't know how robust it is.
And this one's, I know you're going to talk about this. This one, the devil is in the details, like a lot of the stuff. But this, go ahead.
Yeah, no. So it's having a kind of a funeral plan, I guess, is the idea. And that's
What is the funeral plan?
So it's the idea is you have to give regulators, if you're a big, you know, one of these tier one FHCs, you have to have a roadmap to regulators. How, if you teeter on the edge of collapse, you show them how to unwind you, right? So they come in and it's all in place. They don't have to spend weeks or months taking an inventory. Meanwhile, the global economy is melting down. You just show them your roadmap and they'll do it. The catch is
you have this on the shelf.
You have it on the shelf, and the catch is they have to approve it, right? And say, okay, this makes sense. And they say, depending on how complicated it is to unwind you, you have to have that much capital. Right?
Yeah.
And
So that's how the capital requirements would work.
Exactly, exactly. Okay. So the more complicated your plan, the more capital that you have to have on.
Yeah.
And again, there's a feint at this in the proposal about funeral plans. It's just unclear how robust it is and how much the capital requirements will be tied to the complexity of the plan. But I think that's something that's actually realistic, and it would be robust, but you'd have to fight for it.
Well, there's one other version that I've heard that sounds interesting to me, which is as a firm approaches its tier one status,
right.
The capital requirements would increase.
Absolutely, yeah.
And essentially, you could have an FDIC-like fund,
right.
That would finance. That would basically be an insurance program for these for the tier one firms that would help finance the unwinding of the firms.
Right.
You basically tax them as they get bigger, essentially. And the firms that could handle it it was worth their while to get bigger and bigger and bigger would do it, and the ones that didn't wouldn't.
Yep.
So then you're not penalizing anyone if you can handle it, which is what we need to know.
Yep.
We need to know that you can handle being that large, and you can afford it, and you have enough capital, and you have a fund to take care of it if it collapses.
Yeah.
That's I believe where Bayer is on this.
Yeah.
And I think that was part of the conversation when they were writing the plan, but didn't obviously make it. And it'd be interesting to see if Congress picks up on that or not.
No, I agree. And it actually, it's analytically similar to the one, you know, which is basically you can get there, but you have to be able to pay, you know, you have to have the capital on hand, I think is great, you know, because then the banks can't complain, well, you're putting inefficient limits on the size of the financial, you know.
Now, all this rests on all of us being so smart that we can actually figure out which are the firms that pose systemic risk.
Right.
And the fact that the Fed is going to understand which firms they are, and the fact that the firms themselves are going to understand are going to be smart enough to come up with a funeral plan. I mean, as we saw with it was Bayer or Lehman that had all the crap on their books and didn't get rid of it.
Right. No, I think you're right.
So
the sort of knowledge requirements of the whole idea are pretty high, right? Sort of epistemological. It does sort of assume a kind of heroic amount of knowledge on the part of regulators, which, you know. So I agree. I mean, I think, like, better to have the regulators worrying about systemic risk than not, and regulating systemically risky companies than not, but it does assume sort of a heroic amount of knowledge and ability to foresee things.
And then this leads to, and I'm really curious to hear where you come down on this debate. And forgive me if we're repeating too much of your debate with Megan, but the Fed, the other controversial part of this, and this is the one that's really gotten Congress's attention, is putting all this power at the Fed.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
the institution that got us here in the first place, according to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And that already has a pretty important job, you know, monetary policy. What's your take on that? Are we giving them too much or not?
Yeah, I guess I'm a little concerned. I think one of the concerns that actually John Chait, a colleague of mine, a former colleague of yours, brought up at a meeting, which I think is a legitimate one, is just the politicization of the Fed. You know, if suddenly you have all these regulatory powers, you know, maybe you trust Obama and this administration to kind of lay off, but like when it comes time to replace Bernanke or his successor, does the next kind of Bush-style crony capitalist Republican just stick in the Harvey Pitt of the Fed,
right.
And suddenly,
right.
A, you're not even doing the regulatory stuff, but B, the whole monetary policy thing that the Fed is supposed to do also goes to pot.
Yeah.
So I think the politicizing of the Fed is a really legitimate concern. And the second thing is the way the Fed is already conceived, and this is I think where a lot of the critiques come is. The Fed kind of has a dual mandate, particularly like the New York Fed, and this is why I don't think you can be too hard on Geithner himself, because I think it's kind of built into the structure of the institution is, on the one hand, you're supposed to kind of oversee monetary policy. On the other hand, you're supposed to kind of be the government's eyes and ears on Wall Street and sort of liaise with the big banks and see what they're feeling and thinking, and, they're on the board of directors of the New York Fed. It's supposed to be this kind of interactive, collegial sort of exchange, which I think it's just...
Unlike any other regulator, really.
Yeah, unlike any other regulator.
The SEC's not supposed to...
That's right, exactly. So it's really built into the it's kind of hardwired for that. And I just think, like, if the whole point is to have the Fed knock heads together and get tough with an institution that's presenting a systemic risk, it's hard to do that if it's kind of in the DNA of the Fed to be sort of collegial and kind of give and take with banks.
Excellent point.
Do you want to move on to...
Yeah,
okay.
Let's talk... you want to talk about Zeke?
Sure, well, let's...
Or something else first.
Why don't we talk about Milbank Pitney, the great Milbank, Dana Milbank, Nico Pitney smackdown. I'm sure for the two people who haven't heard of this...
Maybe you watch Blogging Heads,
you've heard. All right, so we'll assume knowledge.
I'm assuming it's a...
Let's do that, yeah. give me your take. Among your many areas of expertise, I think, is just your knowledge of the kind of White House press relations. I think you have a very sort of sophisticated, kind of almost anthropological grasp on how this stuff works. What's your take?
First thing is Dana Milbank's I consider a very good friend, so I'm very biased in this situation. On the other hand, I think Nico is one of the best young journalists out there, and I've been obsessively following his coverage from Iran,
uh-huh.
So I don't want to. I have a tough time putting all of my personal
right.
Views
aside.
Let's
just call them like Bob and Dave.
Yeah.
To abstract from the personality.
Exactly.
Sphere, yeah.
Exactly. Look, I think Obama really made life terrible for Nico. And I haven't followed all... I'm sure everything that I'm going to say has been said in one version or another. I'm not following all the blog coverage of this. But the way Obama set up the question himself made it seem all so much more staged than it had to be or than it was. I think people that are criticizing Danny here have to understand that from the White House press corps perspective, the briefing room and the opportunity to question the president is almost like this, this last bastion of journalism where it's not totally manipulated and staged by the White House, and so any effort to sort of inject more politics and more spin and more stage management into that, that single event, the president being questioned, people take very, very seriously. Because let's be honest, there are all sorts of access conversations that journalists have with the White House all the time, and negotiations,
right.
And this and that. But
they're
usually around usually around other types of reporting. That kind of stuff hasn't infected the basic asking the president questions at a press conference event.
Right.
And so I think that's why the reaction was so strong from the White House press corps, that it looked to a lot of reporters like there was too much staging. Now, the question Nico asked in the end was a great question. And as he said in his famous debate with Dana, Obama dodged it. At the end of the day, I do think that should be the test, is whether the question was tough or not. Gets into like the question with Richard Wolff and the access he had with Obama.
Right.
At the end of the day, fine, make all the tools you want for access, but as long as you ask tough questions and you write pieces that are balanced and critical and don't take the White House line as, you know, gospel. So to me, that's the, right. that's the test.
Right. Yeah, I guess so. I take a slightly different view, and I should say most of my colleagues who also like Dana and Rosetten quite a bit have taken Nico Pitney's side of this debate. Jason Zangeli, friend of both of ours. But it makes me a little queasy, I have to say.
And but which part makes you queasy? That,
so I guess the part that made the kind of principle in my mind, and you know, I haven't, you know, excogitated at great length about this, but, you know, I guess what intuitively kind of makes me queasy is doing something for the White House, on behalf of the White House, sort of involving a third party in the way that kind of like a staffer would, you know, that makes me a little weird. Like, suppose it wasn't the situation that we had, but the White House says, you know, we're thinking of holding like a town hall meeting with Iranian exiles. Could you like arrange it for us, you know? And like, I guess I would be like, no, you know, like do that yourself. That's what you have a White House staff for. Even if I arranged it and, you know, there were a bunch of hard questions, the president got roughed up, you know, I still don't feel like I should be in the position of being like doing things that a White House staffer often does or could theoretically do. I don't, you know, I'm happy for other people to have all the negotiations they want sort of one-on-one with the White House over access. I mean, let's not be prudish. It happens all the time. And you just have to trust and hope that the journalist is doing it to kind of advance, you know, advance the game, advance the story and advance our knowledge. But when you start, like, having the journalist be an agent out of the White House, and again, this is extremely marginal. I'm not saying Nico Pitney was an agent. I mean, I think he was, you know, had his heart in the right place. I don't think there was any major ethical transgression. Yeah. I'm just saying the principle, the sort of high principle at work here is kind of doing something on behalf of the White House involving a third party. I think it's weird, and I don't think, again, that it suffices to say that the end result, which was a hard question that kind of wronged the president a bit, makes it okay, because just by sort of agreeing to kind of be an agent of the White House in this extremely weak way already kind of makes it just kind of makes things a little weird.
You know, this is like a tough one. This is one that's going to be studied in journalism schools for a while.
Yeah, because, exactly.
Look, on the one hand, what's the difference between what Nico did and, say, David Leonhardt had an interview with the president this year about the economy.
Right.
Now, I guarantee you that David Leonhardt, which in that interview was fantastic, that piece was fantastic. I think David's coverage of the economy is excellent. But I guarantee you that when David went to the White House, he didn't say, I want an hour with the president, and I'm not telling you what the topic is.
Right, exactly. Just
he
far
said,
away.
I want to do a piece about X, Y, and Z, and I want to ask the president questions like, you know, about the economy. There was a long conversation about what that interview would be about. I guarantee it. I don't know this for a fact, but I would bet my life on it.
Sure, right.
I don't know that that's so different than the White House and Nico talking about, you know, it'd be great to ask, Nico wanting to ask a question at a briefing like any reporter does, the White House being interested in having a question asked about Iran, and them reaching an agreement. I think the only difference is that the press views the press conference itself as sort of, you know, a very pure place that shouldn't be infected by those kinds of deals. But it's not that different than going to the White House and saying, I want to ask the president about this or that.
Right. For me, the only thing that was weird, and I think most people are not weirded out by this at all. I don't think it's where most people have the problem, but it is the White House saying, like, I agree with you in that analogy. The two things seem very similar to me. It's where the White House comes to you and says, find us a question from someone else. So you're like the broker here. You're the question broker, right? And says, go get us a question from an Iranian.
Help me with the chronology. This is important. Did Nico, was he already, before the White House ever contacted him, was he already soliciting questions from Iranians?
It's unclear to me. I know that, you know, I mean, he was clearly, like, blogging very aggressively and in contact with a lot of Iranian, you know, Iranian sources, bloggers, other people. So, it's kind of unclear to me. I haven't established that. But I think whether he was or not, the White House said, we want a question, and you've been in contact, so could you? And I just think that to me is the weird thing, because then it's like, you know, the White House asks you to do something, you hook them up, you know, whereas if you're just negotiating bilaterally for access, the idea is you're getting right. information. You know, you've got a story to do, and you want the information, and you're trying to advance it. And yeah, you may have to make some compromises in how you advance it, but just sort of like in a weird way, kind of doing the administration a favor, you know, and then maybe later on the road, you know, down the road, they'll do you like. It's just it's like slightly weirder to me. And again, like I think he acquitted himself. Like, given what the situation was, I think he acquitted himself extremely well. You know, given that, you know, you could say, well, you know, you can imagine someone with a weaker sort of moral compass saying, like, oh, wow, they really like me. They seem to want to invite me into the fold, so let me kind of hook them up with an easier question, and we'll see where this relationship goes. And he clearly didn't do that, and I think he should be applauded for not doing that. But I think the sort of, you know, just involving this kind of third party to me is a bit strange.
Now, one thing I should say is the way that Dana has been treated by the liberal blogosphere is you know, obviously not every liberal blogger, but in general, there's a lot of amnesia going on here.
Absolutely.
Look, I've known Dana since 1998 when he was covering the White House for the New Republic, and during the Bush years, Dana Milbank was the toughest reporter in the entire White House press corps, holding the Bush administration to account better than anyone else in that press corps.
Right, and they're trying to get him removed, the
psychological abuse that he suffered at the hands of Ari Fleischer and the rest of the White House press shop in those years was, you know, unbelievable. And he never bent, and he never backed down. And there is a rich body of work there that people should remember. So he's not, you know, the idea that one thing that was really disappointing is when Nico argued that because he had one line about the mission accomplished thing, that this meant that Dana wasn't holding the White House to account. I mean, that is just total bullshit. I mean, the guy's been one of the toughest reporters on the White House for years and has paid a price for it over and over again. So it's what happens when these debates arise. I mean, just everyone gets to their battle stations and to their, you know, and everyone forgets what happened, you know, several years ago, even though we theoretically have access to all this stuff.
Right. And that's like the blogosphere, supposedly their specialty, right, is unearthing things that
shifted into, you know, situational ethics.
To war.
Yeah, and let's pull anything we can from either side that advances our case. So, finally on this, the merits aside of who's right, who is wrong, the politics are that the White House. We're seeing the start of a trend story with the White House and the press, where the White House is now starting to get a reputation for overly aggressive press manipulation, and that's always dangerous for a White House. You know, you saw a story today about the audience for one of Obama's events,
Right, and you know, you definitely hear the sort of low-grade chafing. I mean, maybe you always hear it if you go to the White House press room enough. But you definitely get kind of these tremors of like, you know, this is the makings of.
Oh, no doubt. And the press corps has been the actual beat reporters that cover the White House. Yeah. It goes back to the campaign.
The campaign, absolutely. I agree. I mean, you and I.
Yeah, we're incredibly frustrated by you know, the way they're treated, which happens with every administration, with every campaign.
Yeah.
You just start to feel like a hostage and, constantly manipulated. I mean, being a White House beat reporter is, you know, it's not as glamorous as some people might think it is. It's a very, you know, taxing job, and you're just constantly a target for manipulation, and it never ends. And so, you're absolutely right. That backlash has been brewing in the press briefing room for a long time. I think the fact that there was a change in some of the reporters that covered the campaign and those that covered the White House, and, you know, there was a bit of a honeymoon.
Yeah. Gibbs was really smart early on. You know, he had this kind of open door policy, and I think he was very accessible. And I think that bought him some goodwill and some time before the inevitable.
Yeah. And it's coming at a tough moment. You know, now we're going into the phase where the administration, you know, has to show results on the economy. They have to show results on their legislative agenda. And, you know, I saw this up close with the Bush administration. There was no goodwill left when things turned poorly for Bush. He didn't need it after 9/11, and they didn't care about the press. But when things, you know, especially in 2005, when everything turned to crap, there were no defenders left. And so, you know,
Right.
You do risk that by being overly aggressive.
Right. Good. Well, maybe we should leave it there.
Excellent. Well, we didn't get to talk about Zeke Emanuel, but next time.
No, yeah, next time. We'll do a whole blog head just on the Emanuel family, I think. That would be good. The uncle who they're all named after, everything. We'll just do the whole Ari. We'll just include that.
Excellent. Well, a lot of fun, Noam. Good talking to you, and I will see you soon.
Great. Sure. I really enjoyed it, too.
Bye.
All right. Bye.